I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Governor Mike Pence and Senator Tim Kaine faced off last night in the one and only vice presidential debate. Kaine began attacking Pence's running mate Donald Trump right out of the gate, interrupting and interjecting throughout the 90 minutes. Pence dodged the criticism lodged at Trump, avoided defending Trump's most incendiary comments, in fact, denying statements that were, in fact, true. It was a noisy and contentious evening that touched on immigration, Russia, Syria, terrorism, the economy, the police, the Trump and Clinton foundations, Clinton's server, Trump's tax returns, faith, abortion, and nuclear weapons. Here's Tim Kaine and Mike Pence to give you a flavor of the event.
Ronald Reagan said something really interesting about nuclear proliferation back in the 1980s. He said the problem with nuclear proliferation is that some fool or maniac could trigger a catastrophic event. And I think that's who Governor Pence's running mate is, exactly who President Reagan warned us about.
Senator, that was even beneath you and Hillary Clinton, and that's pretty low.
But do you think we should have more nuclear weapons in the world will make us safer?
Senator, Ronald Reagan also said nuclear war should never be fought because it can never be won.
Well, we have more of those clips queued up. Let me introduce our three guests. And with us here in our Philadelphia studio is Matthew Kerbel. He's professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at Villanova University. He blogs at wolvesandsheep.com. Matthew Kerbel, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good to be here, Marty.
And joining us by telephone is Molly Ball, politics writer for The Atlantic. And Molly, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Great to be here.
And Julian Zelizer joining us from the studios of Princeton University, where he's a professor of history and public affairs, also a fellow at New America. And Julian Zelizer, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me.
Molly, let me begin with you. I already put this question to Matt, and I just want to give you a chance to start off our conversation. I'm trying to imagine someone that had never heard of either of these two candidates, had not been following the presidential race, had never heard either Pence or Kaine speak, what you think their first impression, their takeaway from last night's event would be.
That's a good way of putting it, since I think it's probably the reality for a lot of people that they knew very little about these vice presidential candidates, although I think the top of the ticket is pretty well known.
Sure.
And I think the impression that they got was of Mike Pence as a sort of stable, reassuring, calm, conventional Republican with conservative political positions and someone who is civil and doesn't get too worked up about things. Kaine came across much more as a sort of jumpy attack dog, overeager, and obsessed with Donald Trump. And that was the point of the debate for him, and I think that was what he wanted to accomplish, was to keep the focus on Donald Trump. But in the process, he didn't necessarily put forward a particularly positive portrait of himself as a person and a politician.
What could you imagine, Julian?
Well, I could imagine they wouldn't understand who the main nominee is and what all the fuss is about. So Pence clearly and very conscientiously depicted himself as the antithesis of Donald Trump in this debate. His demeanor was very calm. He appealed in many ways on, at the end, social policy, but also on national security policy to rather traditional conservative themes. And he did employ systematic attacks against Hillary Clinton for issues like the foundation. So I don't think he appeared to be a nominee, but he certainly didn't appear like the kind of Republican that's at the top of the ticket. So he gave a very different appearance, and that was the point. The point was, in many ways, to change the news story from what has been going on in the last week, and he probably was able to do that.
Matt, go ahead.
Yeah, I would agree with Julian and Molly. If I were watching this, I would wonder what happened to the presidential election, because here you have two really professional politicians debating in a much more conventional sense. So the debate didn't have any of the professional wrestling quality that the presidential contest has had. I do think that if I could add a point about the dynamic last night, I do think that it was Kaine's strategy to debate Donald Trump. He did it by raising a lot of points, mentioning specific statements that Trump had made, and basically challenging Mike Pence to defend them. And Pence, by and large, didn't defend them. His response was to suggest that, in fact, Trump never said these things, which is sort of an odd tack to take in an era where we have YouTube and we can fact check these things.
I mean, Molly, Pence took the job, so this comes with the job. But it was interesting to watch him avoid, evade, and in certain cases, really misrepresent what his running mate had said about a whole host of issues that we are all so familiar with.
That's right. I think the biggest moment of cognitive dissonance came when Mike Pence forcefully attacked Vladimir Putin and attacked Hillary Clinton for having been too soft on Russia when, as anyone who's been following this knows, Donald Trump has very openly cozied up to Putin, has flattered him, said nice things about him, and has had some ties to the Kremlin. And so you could see Tim Kaine just looking bewildered at the complete opposite nature of the Republican presidential nominee's rhetoric and his running mates. And it is the kind of thing that, you know, I think Pence did a good job in potentially winning over a lot of Republican voters who are not sure about Donald Trump. Trump's biggest weakness right now is with Republican voters or Republican-leaning voters who are just not sure about him. And so to be reassured that there is someone like Mike Pence who's a much more traditional Republican who's in the room with Trump, who's on the ticket with Trump, could potentially do Trump some real good. But at the same time, you know, as Matt was just saying, Pence really did not defend Trump's positions. He just put forward his own.
Well, Julian, Kaine has been criticized for being the attack dog. And I know in many ways that's the job of a vice president to do that. But do you think he needed a muzzle, or do you think he was doing his job?
He probably did his job. I'm not sure the way in which he did it was as effective as others we have seen in the past, like when Vice President Cheney debated and very skillfully ripped apart his opponent. In a more systematic, calm fashion. I think he probably could have had a different demeanor, and all the lines he delivered would have been that much more effective. But at this point, what Hillary Clinton wants is to keep the focus on all the problems with Donald Trump. She doesn't have much interest or need to sell Kaine. And so it's a very different kind of vice presidential debate that she was looking for. So all the lines are out there. The discussion about various issues from gender to immigration are out there because of what Kaine said. And so in that way, he did fulfill his role.
Matt, the lead up to this was it was going to be boring. It was going to be too wonky, too policy driven. That doesn't matter what vice presidents say. Do you think that still holds true in 2016?
Well, I do think that there was more policy substance in the discussion than we saw in the presidential debate. To your question about whether vice presidential debates matter, these debates tend to be reinforcing events. They tend to reinforce the impressions that people come in with. So, again, strategically, to the extent that the Clinton campaign was looking to reinforce some of the more over-the-top statements that Donald Trump has made, that was what Tim Kaine tried to do. And I would agree with Julian that stylistically there may have been a better way to approach it. But he certainly did make that point. And then Mike Pence, of course, wanting to reassure more traditional conservatives that Donald Trump is a safe bet. I think that to the extent that he was able to present a calm demeanor, and remember, he started as a radio talk show host.
I do remember.
Right. So he was able to do that.
Well, but I wonder, Molly, just because we're talking about 2016 and Donald Trump. Meanwhile, Donald Trump is tweeting during the event while his running mate is on the air, you know, trying to address all these criticisms. What do you make of that?
It was another moment of cognitive dissonance, right? Because you had Mike Pence on stage saying, "I can't believe you're being so insulting. Your campaign is the one driven by insults." Meanwhile, Donald Trump is literally slinging insults online about Tim Kaine, retweeting people saying nasty things about the way Kaine looked and sounded. I do want to quibble slightly with what Julian was saying, because I agree that Cain did a very good job of attacking Donald Trump and continuing to sow those doubts about Donald Trump. I think he had another job, too, and that's the one he failed at, which was making people feel making people like Hillary Clinton more. And we heard at the beginning of the debate him saying repeatedly, "I trust Hillary Clinton because." And so that was clearly one of the messages he wanted to get across. I like Hillary Clinton, therefore you should like Hillary Clinton. You should stop believing, you know, this caricature of her as a horrible, untrustworthy, dislikable person. And I think that because Cain didn't himself come off as very likable, he didn't do a good job of improving Hillary Clinton's image in that regard.
You're nodding there, Matt.
Yeah, I think that one of the difficulties that the Clinton campaign has had throughout the election, really, has been putting forward a positive message about the candidate. And you know, I think part of the problem here is that Donald Trump just sucks so much of the oxygen out of the room. So really, this election has been about Donald Trump. I think we saw that in the first presidential debate, where it looked like Hillary Clinton was trying to put forward a positive message about herself, a positive reason to support her. And it really just got lost in the theatrics.
Julian, do you think Pence was also teeing himself up, or at least putting out the idea that he could be a presidential candidate 4 years hence?
Without question. I thought that's part of the separation from Donald Trump. Part of it is the theatrics of a Trump campaign that likes to consistently send mixed messages to the electorate. I mean, we have seen that through Trump, and now we're seeing it with Trump and his vice presidential candidate. So there's a little bit of everything for everyone. And it's hard to pin him down as just being about one set of issues. But Pence also has aspirations that go beyond this campaign. And the reality is, if Donald Trump loses and he runs in 4 years, he might be running against Donald Trump. But even if he's not, he will have to separate himself, as will much of the Republican Party, from this campaign. Donald Trump can be a liability for future candidates. So the separation that you saw and his distance from a lot of the core arguments that Donald Trump has made in this campaign also serves his self-interest. I just want to add,
sure,
the other part of this is that vice presidents are pretty important these days. It's an interesting phenomenon. Since the 60s, the institution has become much more significant. Most vice presidents, Biden, Cheney, are big policy players, like Al Gore. And so it's interesting. We think of the debate still only as a way to understand the main ticket or the main candidate. But we probably should be paying more attention to who they are as policymakers and as leaders, because even if they keep this role in the next 4 years, they're gonna play a big part in the White House.
Hence the reason for our show. Let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking about last night's vice presidential debate between Indiana Governor Mike Pence, Virginia Senator Tim Kaine. That's Julian Zelizer. He's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, a fellow at New America. Wrote a book most recently, The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress, and the Battle for the Great Society. Molly Ball with us as well. She's a politics writer for The Atlantic. And Matthew Kerbel with us here in our Philadelphia studio, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at Villanova University. He blogs at wolvesandsheep.com. 1-888-477-9499, the number to call to join our conversation. We've got a lot of comments already. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Molly Ball, Julian Zelizer, Matthew Kerbel about last night's vice presidential debate. And here's another clip, in fact, a lightly edited clip we put together, Mike Pence and Tim Kaine's exchange about the tones of their campaigns, or I should say, of each other's campaigns.
He says ours is an insult-driven campaign. Did you all just hear that? Ours is an insult-driven campaign. I mean, to be honest with you, if Donald Trump had said all the things that you said he said in the way you said he said them, he still wouldn't have a fraction of the insults that Hillary Clinton leveled when she said that half of our supporters were a basket of deplorables. That she said they were irredeemable. They were not America.
Hillary Clinton said something on the campaign trail, and the very next day she said, you know what, I shouldn't have said that.
She said she shouldn't have said half.
Governor, this is Senator Kaine's 2 minutes, please.
Look, yeah, that's right. So now we're even.
Yeah.
look for Donald Trump apologizing to John McCain for saying he wasn't a hero? Did Donald Trump apologize for calling women slobs, pigs, dogs, disgusting?
She apologized for saying...
Governor, it is his two minutes, please. Did
Donald Trump apologize for taking after somebody in a Twitter war and making fun of her weight? Did he apologize for saying African-Americans are living in hell? Did he apologize for saying President Obama was not even a citizen of the United States? You will look in vain to see Donald Trump ever taking responsibility for anybody and apologizing.
Molly, who wins that argument, do you think? Even not just last night, but over the course of the last bunch of months.
Well, that's a tough one, because that was another instance where, you know, you had Mike Pence literally denying. It was a sort of who are you going to believe, me or your lying eyes moment, right? Because Trump has said all of those things. At the same time, you know, Cain had a hard time defending Hillary Clinton for her comment about the deplorables, which has become sort of a rallying cry, at least among Trump's hardcore supporters. You go to Trump's events and there are people wearing all of these deplorables-themed T-shirts. They've really embraced that as a symbol of Hillary Clinton's attitude, which they find condescending. And I think that Mike Pence did a very good job of sort of milking that comment for everything it was worth and trying to turn the table. So, you know, to the extent that Pence's job was to sort of muddy the waters about which campaign is negative, which campaign was insulting, he did that pretty effectively. But for him to try to get on his high horse and insist that Trump is not the one in this campaign who's doing most of the insulting, I think it will be difficult for anyone who's paying attention to believe.
What do you think, Matt?
Well, I think that, you know, the dilemma facing the Trump campaign is that Pence needs to do more than shore up conservatives. He needs to reach out and widen his share of the electorate, or Trump's share of the electorate, if Trump is going to win this election. And so, you know, I'm not really sure that getting into the mud over questions of who's telling the truth is really going to do that.
Well, I wonder, too, when you see, Julian, some of the changing polls over the last, certainly over since the conventions this past summer, do you think it's people leaving the Clinton and Trump camp and going to the other side? Is it these people in the middle that are just waking up that there is a presidential campaign? They haven't decided who they want. What do you make of some of the fluidity here?
Well, it's pretty remarkable to see. There's always some fluidity after the convention. Often one side gets a bounce, and then a few weeks later, as you get into September, they tighten. But I think what certainly has taken some observers by surprise is just how big the changes were. So there was just a huge burst of support for Hillary Clinton after, where it seemed that her support was even cutting into Republican places in states like Georgia or Utah. But then in recent weeks, it tightened rather dramatically. And so it would suggest that there are people, more people than usual, who are still not decided about who they dislike less, which seems to be part of this campaign. You know, I don't know where the polls are right now, but I do think they are dynamic enough that any predictions that the current trend is the future trend are probably going to be off.
What do you think, Molly?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think the key point there is, who do you dislike less? Because these are the two least popular nominees in presidential history, Donald Trump the most unpopular presidential nominee and Hillary Clinton the second most unpopular, there is a large swath of the electorate that doesn't like either of their choices. About a quarter of the electorate dislikes both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. It's not just a phenomenon of, you know, her supporters don't like him and his supporters don't like her. And so those people are having a really tough time voting for the lesser evil or figuring out which one they dislike less. And as I go around the country and talk to undecided voters, it's often the people who are paying attention the closest who have the toughest time deciding. And so they're easily pulled between the candidates. They're easily swayed by the latest development that makes them think, okay, this one is unacceptable. And then something happens in the other direction, and they say, oh, no, it's the other one that's unacceptable. And, you know, the latest movement is we've seen a lot of movement in Hillary Clinton's direction since the last debate. And whenever that happens, the question becomes, is that a trend? that will continue to accelerate in her direction, or is it a blip and we are going to go back to sort of a steady state equilibrium once that effect dissipates? And so, you know, I think people are going to be watching the next couple of debates almost as closely as they watched the first one.
And it's not the first time, Matt, I've heard the lesser of two evils. I think oftentimes voters feel like that is the choice we have, the lesser of two evils.
We've heard that before, but I think it's particularly pronounced this year. And so as Molly was just saying, when you have a block of the electorate that's just unhappy with the choice, they really don't want either of these candidates. I think what we see in the polling has to do more with intensity than the direction of preference. So in other words, when people who are perhaps leaning towards a candidate, if they're able to convince themselves for the time being that, okay, I can see myself voting for them, I think that explains a lot of the movement in the polls. So when weak supporters of Hillary Clinton are, you know, willing to commit, at least for the time being, and we saw that after the convention, we saw it again after the presidential debate, then her numbers tend to go up, and you know, they can go down again as well. But I do think that on balance, the public opinion has been a bit more stable than some of these fluctuations suggest. I think there's a pool of voters that are available to each of these candidates, and what we're seeing is really just movement around the margins.
That's Matthew Kerbel from Villanova University, also with us Molly Ball from The Atlantic, and Julian Zelizer from Princeton University, talking about last night's vice presidential debate. I do want to read a bunch of comments here. They are scrolling at me, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. In fact, let me get Emily from Phoenixville to join our conversation. Emily, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, I just wanted to comment about this, discussing how successful Tim Kaine was last night. The discussion has been about how likable he was and whether he made Hillary Clinton more likable. And honestly, I don't think that was his main mission. From my point of view, he was out there arguing for former Bernie Sanders, who wanted to see someone who's angry, fed up, not going to put up with craziness. And I think he did a great job doing that. I think the greatest threat to Hillary Clinton is people who are going to vote for a third-party candidate. And I think he went out there and he fought for those votes. And I think he was very successful.
Emily, that's really interesting. Let me see what Molly Ball, Julian Zelizer, and Matthew Kerbel think. Molly, I'll start with you.
I would disagree with that analysis a little bit. I mean, the problem that we've seen Hillary Clinton having with her base, essentially, is that young people are not excited about her candidacy, and people of color are not nearly as excited about her as they were about President Obama in his two elections. And so if Tim Kaine's task is to make them enthusiastic enough to vote, I'm not sure he accomplished that. I don't think we see that defections to third-party candidates are a major phenomenon. Mm-hmm. Both the Libertarian and the Green Party candidates, who I think were expected to get a lot of traction this year because of that dynamic of the candidates being disliked, they're both in single digits and have actually been sinking in the polls recently, probably due to their own characteristics. People are willing to cast a protest vote, but not for someone that they don't like any better than the major party candidates. So, you know, I just have not seen a lot of evidence that former Bernie Sanders supporters are looking for something like they saw last night. I don't think that the performance that Kaine put on was particularly Bernie-esque, either in terms of promoting a strongly progressive ideology or in terms of channeling the sort of Sanders anger at the status quo.
You teach at a university. Matthew, so do you, Julian. Assuming with some interactions with young people, Matt, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think that defections among young people to third-party candidates is a concern for the Clinton campaign. I don't know that you know, what Tim Kaine did last night was Bernie-esque on substance. You know, I would suggest that it wasn't. So I'm not sure that his strategy was to try to motivate or energize Bernie's supporters on behalf of Hillary Clinton. But if he had that effect, then you know, obviously that would be a plus for the Clinton campaign.
What do you think, Julian?
I think it's less about mobilizing the Sanders supporters than mobilizing the Obama coalition of 2008, which is much broader in many ways than what Sanders was able to put together. And I do think it's true that part of Tim Kaine's task right now. And the task of Hillary Clinton is to make sure the turnout is as robust as it needs to be in some of these contested areas, such as Pennsylvania and the other states that we've been talking about. I think, though, if that's the strategy, it's not the best strategy. I mean, the two mistakes Hillary Clinton has made with this strategy, in my opinion, the first is to attack Donald Trump supporters rather than Donald Trump. That was the issue that got her tied up with the deplorable speech, and I don't think that really works. And then just to focus on Trump and not herself. The moments when she shines and there's excitement and you see that handful of voters that Matthew's talking about move has been when she was front and center. She was front and center in the convention, her story, her skills, her record, and in the debate in many ways. It was a response not only to Trump and the many things he did, especially in the last half of the debate, but just her poise, her knowledge. I think all of that plays well. So I think if she wants to do what Emily is suggesting, although I think it's a bigger coalition she's aiming for, she is going to have to make sure she does not get sucked into a campaign that is entirely about Donald Trump in this next month.
Well, let me play another clip. And I should say that Senator Kaine raised Donald Trump's taxes or tax returns, his unwillingness to release any tax returns multiple times last night. Let's give a listen to one of the back and forth.
And with regard to paying taxes, this whole riff about not paying taxes and people saying he didn't pay taxes for years, Donald Trump has created tens of thousands of jobs, and he's paid payroll taxes, sales taxes.
Senator, I'm going to give you about 30 seconds to respond, and I have a question on Social Security.
Hillary Clinton is going to raise taxes, and Donald Trump and I are going to cut them.
Donald Trump started this campaign in 2014. He said, if I run for president, I will absolutely release my taxes. He's broken his first promise. Second, he stood on the stage last
week.
He stood on the stage last week, and when Hillary said you haven't been paying taxes, he said, that makes me smart. So it's smart not to pay for our military. It's smart not to pay for veterans. It's smart not to pay for teachers. And I guess all of us who do pay for those things, I guess we're stupid.
Molly, is this hurting Donald Trump? Can you tell?
I think the tax issue is hurting Donald Trump. You know, there was a poll taken last week before the New York Times story that found that actually disclosed some of Trump's tax returns came out. Even before that, there was a question asked a little bit clumsily, but the question was basically, do you think people have a civic duty to pay taxes, or do you think that taxes are bad and people should pay as little as possible? And 86% of likely voters in that poll said everyone has a civic duty to pay taxes. Now, you know, you can say what Pence is saying, well, Trump pays a lot of different kinds of taxes, just not those, not federal income taxes.
Well, we all do that, don't we?
Right. Or you know, Trump's being a smart businessman and the tax code is that way for a reason, to incentivize investment. But on a gut level of fairness, I think it strikes people as problematic that Trump, a really rich guy who seems to be living really well, is getting away with something that most people don't feel they get away with. And so, you know, particularly because Trump's appeal is to people who feel they're getting screwed by the system, and his line has always been, well, I've exploited this rigged system, so I know how to fix it. I think it's a tough issue for him, and people have consistently, you know, in polls and in my conversations with people, said they would like to know what is in his tax returns.
What do you think, Julian?
Yeah, it challenges his whole argument about conservative populism, that he actually is someone who is both like average Americans and who will really fight for average Americans. It raises questions about his transparency. He's a person who keeps telling us he'll tell it like it is. He'll be straight with us. And yet he seems to be hiding his taxes. And now we discover things aren't exactly what they were. And finally, the story of his business losses is something that the Democrats have picked up on, which they haven't quite exploited yet. Questions about whether he is the business person he has claimed to be, because that's how he's running this campaign as well. He is a person who will bring his business skills, his ability to make a deal, to politics. But if he can't do that in business, and if he suffered enormous losses at different points, that raises questions. So I think it opens him up on a number of levels. I'm not sure it's damaged him severely yet, but it's clearly a vulnerability that Democrats are going to run with.
And clearly that's part of his appeal, Matthew, to his supporters.
It's absolutely a part of his appeal to his supporters. It's also a central tenet of his self-image. And I wouldn't lose sight of the fact that the more his business practices are challenged, the more that Trump runs the risk of going into one of those unhinged phases. He tends to do that when he's challenged directly on something that he sees as being beyond question. So I think if we look ahead to the next two debates, the more this story continues to gain steam, the more reporters look into the broader question of his business practices, the more he runs the risk of being in a position where he could act out like he did in the first debate.
How do you think the moderator did, Matt?
Last night? Well, you know, I don't know if it's possible to moderate these things. You know, the two candidates come in with a game plan. They intend to implement that game plan. But she did lose control of the debate early on and couldn't get it back.
What do you think, Molly? About a minute before our break here, did she lose control?
Yes, and she seemed fixated on getting through her list of questions rather than allowing conversation to continue. I think she could have interjected herself less because the candidates were actually having good substantive exchanges when they weren't just bickering. And we could have learned more on a few topics, but she seemed fixated on sort of enforcing time limits and questions rather than allowing the conversation to flow.
Julian, what do you think?
Yeah, it was a mix of both not having control in the beginning and a somewhat robotic performance where there were moments, glimmers of interesting conversations, which we never see in debates, about policy, about issues, certainly about religion and faith in politics. But I felt she kept moving on and at the same time not pushing back when things moved in a different direction. So it wasn't the best. But again, it's really difficult in this day and age to handle these events.
And that's Julian Zelizer from Princeton University. Also with us, Molly Ball from The Atlantic and Matthew Kerbel from Villanova University, talking about last night's vice presidential debate. And we do have another section queued up where they did talk about faith and abortion. We want to hear from you. What did you make of the debate last night, and what are you looking for certainly on Sunday night? 1-888-477-9499. Radio Times at WHYY.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with my guests and with you about last night's vice presidential debate. We have three pages of comments here. Let me read some tweets from Peter. Yes, vice presidential debate indeed. I believe it will have a great influence on the election. A tweet from Mr. C. What I get from some younger Philly folks is refusing to vote to avoid endorsing either. A tweet from Sue. It's simple. Love versus hate. Good versus evil. 2016 is about survival, women, minorities, civil rights, and then a hashtag for Clinton Kane. We have a bunch of other comments as well, which I will read during this segment that we're in. Let me read a couple here. Kane had a tougher job defending the crooked career politician by spewing out canned lines and lies just like his running mate. A comment from Mary. Actually, the moderator missed a chance to correct a lie about the Clinton Foundation. Mr. Pence claimed the Clinton Foundation gives less than 10% of its funds to programs. That is actually true. They give, I think, closer to 85 to 90%. A comment from Ty. Let me jump over that. A tweet from William. It was a disappointing loss for Ted Cruz, I guess, talking about how Pence positioned himself. A tweet from Amy. The only reason people think Governor Pence won was because he stayed calm. Tim Kaine brought up great points and it gets lost. 1-888-477-9499. I mean, Matthew, there's a question about turnout. We don't know that. We won't know that for the next 5 weeks or so. But it does seem people are engaged, whether they're just angry or engaged. I guess time will tell.
And a lot of people are afraid, too. And if you look at the way people are looking at this election, you have on both sides the sense that if the other candidate wins, that's going to be the end of the Republic as we know it. And I think if we look beyond the election, that raises big questions about how to deal with the fallout. Related to that are questions of the legitimacy of this election. You have, on occasion, Donald Trump suggesting that he might not accept the outcome if he loses. And that could have serious ramifications.
Molly, you have written about a fear, I guess, fear and anger. It is a great motivator. Is it good for politics, though, and this political season?
Well, it's important in the politics of now. I guess I'm not going to say it's good or bad, but it's real. And what we've seen, you know, I did write an article looking at fear specifically and the effect that it has on politics. And what we see right now is that the level of fear in the electorate, people saying that they are concerned that they or a loved one will personally be victims, particularly of crime or terrorism, that is at its highest point since September 11th. And it has risen about 20 percentage points just in the last couple of years. There is a feeling of the electorate is freaked out, right? Particularly Trump supporters. And that's a lot of what has driven people to Trump is this sort of strongman aura that he has, the idea that he's going to protect the country from the scary things on the outside, whether they're scary people, scary foreigners, or scary forces like ISIS. And so, you know, I think that that has been a big dynamic here. And I think, as Matt was saying, because this electorate is so polarized and so negatively motivated right now, whoever wins this election is going to have a very difficult task to try to bring the country together and try to move forward and try to do something resembling governing because people are so divided and so worried about the future.
Julian, should voters be afraid? Should Americans be afraid for being attacked in the streets, either by a criminal or a terrorist?
Well, there's always things to be scared about. So we always face national security risks. We always face certain domestic risks. I think the other fear some people have, certainly many Democrats, is literally what happens if this Republican candidate is president, which is a little bit like when Barry Goldwater ran in 64. A lot of the fear is not rational. It's not as if you looked and weighed different kinds of risks that you face, that the ones we actually care about are the big ones. But this is politics. And there are elections when certain issues revolving around fear come to the forefront, and candidates who play to those fears more effectively can win. In 1968, it was about Vietnam and law and order, and Richard Nixon made this the centerpiece of his campaign. And when Hubert Humphrey played Happy Days Are Here Again at the Democratic Convention, no one was buying it. And in 1980, we think of Ronald Reagan as the sunny optimist, but his campaign was all about a country that had gone off the tracks and was falling apart economically. It was falling apart overseas, and he used those fears and the anger in the electorate to win. So we shouldn't discount or undersell how much power they can have, even if, again, in this case on paper, the risks might be exaggerated in some ways from people's daily lives.
Let me play one more clip from last night. And frankly, I thought this was the most interesting part. It came at the very end. The candidates were asked about their faith and how they struggle when their faith really doesn't line up with the laws of the land or the policies of the land. And this is Senator Tim Kaine, Governor Mike Pence, discussing their campaign's position on abortion.
We support Roe versus Wade. We support the constitutional right of American women to consult their own conscience, their own supportive partner, their own minister, but then make their own decision about pregnancy. That's something we trust American women to do that. And we don't think that women should be punished, as Donald Trump said they should, for making the decision to have an abortion. Governor Pence wants to repeal Roe versus Wade. He said he wants to put it on the ash heap of history. And we have some young people in the audience who weren't even born when Roe was decided. This is pretty important. Before Roe versus Wade, states could pass criminal laws to do just that, to punish women if they made the choice to terminate a pregnancy. I think you should live your moral values. But the last thing, the very last thing that government should do is have laws that would punish women who make reproductive choices. And that is the fundamental difference between a Clinton-Kaine ticket and a Trump-Pence ticket that wants to punish women who make
choice. It's really not. Donald Trump and I would never support legislation that punished
women who made the heartbreaking choice to end a pregnancy.
And why did Donald Trump say that?
We just never would.
Why did he say that?
Well, look, look, he's not a polished politician like you and Hillary Clinton.
Molly, what's so interesting about Tim Kaine is personally opposed to abortion, but he's spent, you know, most of his life in some form of elective office. He's decided that this is a decision that a woman makes, and it's not one that he is going to make. There was much more to that discussion about their faith and all of that. What's your takeaway?
It was a really interesting moment in the debate, and a really a less snippy, sort of more heartfelt moment for both of these men. And there's a little bit of an irony on both sides, right? Because for Tim Kaine, this is a sort of a rare moment that the tables were turned, and he's the one who has a little bit of distance from the top of the ticket in terms of his personal beliefs about abortion and even on some of the policy, such as the Hyde Amendment on federal funding. For Mike Pence, you know, I think this was a moment where his very heartfelt pro-life testimony might have convinced some conservatives who don't trust Donald Trump on that issue. Donald Trump has a history of being quite socially liberal, including supporting abortion rights, and that has kept a lot of religious voters and conservative voters from being able to support him, and I think Pence could have been a reassuring voice there. And it was yet another instance, though, where Pence could not defend something that Donald Trump has said and chose to merely change the subject and deny that it was the case.
What do you think, Matt?
I agree with Molly that this was a particularly revealing exchange, maybe the most revealing exchange of the entire debate, because I felt both candidates were speaking from the heart rather than from prepared talking points. And I think it did point out a real question about how you govern. You know, if you personally hold views, maybe profoundly, deeply hold views that are at odds with the way we have, as a nation, have decided to proceed legally. How do you manage that? How do you deal with that? And we don't usually get that kind of discussion in an era where you know, we're only allowed to talk about things for 30 seconds at a time. So, you know, I thought in that sense it was actually quite revealing.
Well, and Julian, I know that when Mike Pence talks about himself, he's a Christian first and a Republican third, which is, and he has said that quite often. I think that's a interesting and revealing statement about himself.
It is, although in this case the two go together. I thought, you know, it's a sad statement that when we see two candidates actually talking about a substantive issue calmly, we are all taking note of it. It says a lot about how the rest of the debates go. But, you know, I think Pence was saying, making an argument that will really resonate with solidly Republican voters. It's not a statement that will expand the number of voters that appeal to Donald Trump. Kaine said something, I think, even though he's in the middle, even though he has a much more complicated position, I think it reflects where a much broader part of the public is. So in some ways, I thought that was the most effective part of his middle way on this issue. I think that is where many more American voters sit, and that's an important issue. He also avoided gay rights, which in many ways on social issues is a vulnerability for Pence that is quite grand, where I think the Democrats really could go after him as being far much more to the right of the political spectrum than many are at this point. But that really didn't come up in the debate.
Let me read a couple more comments. One from Richard. I'm just going to summarize the very end. He said, if we had third parties in the debates, we'd have a real substantial discussion. An email from David. I thought it was so obvious that Pence was mimicking Ronald Reagan's style of false sincerity and over-earnestness mixed with a subtle pompousness. Did people really fall for that? An email from Adam. Pence's constant scoffing was maddening. When Kaine quoted Trump, he called it an avalanche of insults. Kaine did a good job defending many of Clinton's stances. Let me get Nancy from Germantown to join our conversation with a slightly different point of view. And Nancy, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you. That I live in a retirement community in Germantown, and I have not found a single person among either residents, patients, or staff who are supporting Trump. But as older people, we were all shocked by the way that Kane kept interrupting Pence. He looked as if he was trying to do an SNL imitation of Trump. So many of us are feeling very confused this morning.
Well, Nancy, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Great that people at our retirement community are watching Saturday Night Live. Molly, this is, I don't know whether this is something that an older person might be more offended by than a younger person, but obviously Nancy and her cohort not happy about Kane's performance.
Yeah, well, I think that this has been a campaign that turns very much on questions of demeanor and temperament. And one of Kane's, you know, big attacks on Donald Trump and Mike Pence by proxy last night was, here's someone you can't trust with his finger on the nuclear button. And I think the comparison to Trump was a bit apt there, not because they have anything substantive in common, but because Kane was someone who did seem so sort of jumpy and interrupty, just as Trump was criticized for interrupting Hillary Clinton constantly in their first debate. And so, you know, so many voters have told me, maybe particularly older voters, but I think a lot of people feel that we could use more civility and more even-tempered political candidates. And to the extent that, you know, there was a commenter saying that they found Pence a bit smarmy, and certainly some people perceived it that way because he was constantly just sort of shaking his head and pursing his lips at Kane's attacks. But in terms of demeanor, I think Pence definitely seemed like the more calm and folksy and level-headed one.
Let me read an email from Kate from New Hope. Julian, I'll put this to you. Kate writes, we only have 5 days away from the next presidential debate. What's the likelihood that Donald Trump will feel upstaged by Pence's performance? Quote, unquote, he's not a polished politician, weak to no defense of Donald Trump, et cetera. As a result, it sort of devolves from there, but basically saying, did Pence then put pressure on Donald Trump to perform differently on Sunday night compared to what he did on Monday night this week? Was it Monday night? I've lost track here. No, go ahead, Julian.
I mean, that would be a good thing for Donald Trump. If that's the case, then Pence will have helped the ticket. I'm not convinced that's how Donald Trump sees the world. I'm not sure he sees someone working with him or working somewhere else and feels they outdid him, and he has to show that they're better. I think he has a sense of superiority, which is part of his aura. I'm not convinced that watching this performance is going to transform the way Donald Trump has his debate, especially in this town hall format next week. I mean, he was literally live tweeting all these insults as this was going on, comparing him to a Batman villain or agreeing with the comment about that. So I think the Donald Trump we keep seeing is the one who will reappear, and he'll have to win or lose on those merits.
Matt, I'm giving you the last word. Go ahead.
I agree with that. I think that the Donald Trump we've seen is Donald Trump, and I don't really think that watching somebody else perform in a debate is really going to affect the way he goes about handling himself in the next debate.
And the next debate is a town hall debate. Does that create unique challenges, Matt?
It does. For one thing, Hillary Clinton is actually quite practiced at doing town hall debates, and Donald Trump is not. So he has to be more aware of some of the things that I think affected him during the first debate, such as body language and the way he talks to ordinary people. And he certainly has to be aware that if somebody challenges him and he's not used to being challenged, that he handles that well.
Well, we're going to end on that note. My thanks to all three of you. Matthew Kuberl, thanks for coming in, joining us here on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome. Professor, chair of the Department of Political Science at Villanova University. He blogs at wolvesandsheep.com. Molly Ball, thank you very much for joining us as well.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Politics writer for The Atlantic. And Julian, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as always.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Professor of History and Public Affairs at Princeton University, a fellow at the New America Foundation. And we had many, many comments, tweets, email comments and things like that, unable to get them all on the air, frankly, to keep up with them. But we're really thrilled that you are as interested in this political race as we are. So you can carry on that conversation on our Facebook page. I'm Marty Moskowing. Thanks for joining us.